evening and welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm Catherine Garvins and I'll be your host for this evening. Studies show that just 120 minutes of time outdoors per week can have lasting benefits to human mental and physical health. We'll talk more about that with my guest this evening. We'll be listening to my interview with Colleen Robinson. Colleen is a Madison-born environmental educator, mindful outdoor guide, and self-proclaimed lifelong student of the living earth. During the pandemic, she earned her Mindful Outdoor Guide certification, discovering the missing piece of her environmental education and communications career. In her work, she helps others reawaken and nurture their inherent connection to the natural context by sharing simple daily practices. She is also a Wisconsin Master Naturalist course instructor, communications manager for a national nonprofit, and in her free time she plays bass in several bluegrass bands and volunteers for cooperative living communities. Colleen, welcome to the airwaves.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. To start, can you tell me more about how you became interested in this field?
Sure. I have been feeling a deep connection to nature and the natural spaces around me as long as I can remember. I credit it to my parents, as do many people in the research, actually, that have a strong environment connection. And my education and degree is in environmental education. I love that work. I've spent most of my time since college working with adult programming versus environmental ed for kids. But I've done both, quite a bit of both. And I felt for a very long time like there was something missing. And in 2016, I suffered an injury that really changed how I could engage outdoors. And it led me to needing to find avenues for meditation and redefining how I was relating to my natural context. And when I found certified mindful outdoor guiding, it was, I remember jumping up and down in my bedroom with excitement, and I dove right in, and it really has filled that gap of what I felt was missing in my environmental career. And I can talk more about that.
Recently, going back a few years now, there's been this emerging field of environmental neuroscience. Can you speak a bit about your understanding about what environmental neuroscience is and how it dovetails with what you do?
Sure. Well, neuroscience itself is the study of the nervous system with a main focus on brain function and structures and how those interact with our physiology and our behavior. And environmental neuroscience just extends that, I'd say, to that study, including our environmental context. And that can be any environment. It doesn't have to be natural contexts or natural environments, but it's this study of how does the environment we're in interact with and affect the very structures and functioning of our brain, our nervous system, and then how does that also reflect back into our environment?
And can you speak about what that impact is?
Sure. There is a growing body of science that is studying the effects of our cognitive and physical health from being in nature spaces. And a lot of people are familiar with this term of forest bathing. It's becoming more and more familiar recently. Started in Japan in response to a real worker crisis, mental health in the labor force crisis. And so studies were coming out of there, and now they're being built upon here in Canada and Korea. And it's showing things that are surprising, but if we stop back and think about it, they really make a whole lot of sense. So we're seeing that time in nature or green spaces can reduce the experiences of depression, can reduce stress and anxiety, can improve ADHD and other attention deficit symptoms. It has a restorative property for attention and ability to focus. It reduces blood pressure. It reduces the production of cortisol, which is a stress hormone. It can help with variable heart rate and also regulate heart rate. Important things for athletes, especially athletes outdoors. And it also has these effects of reducing a person's sense of loneliness, apathy, and increases our instances where we're feeling inspired or empowered, creative, empathetic, compassionate. It's really quite a model. And these physical effects make a lot of sense because our bodies as humans, all humans have this in common, have evolved over time in our natural context. And we are a product of, I like to say, we're made of and by each other. And that's true in our daily lives and our interactions with one another. It's also true from an evolutionary standpoint of how we were formed and how we function based on millennia of growing and changing within our environment. I can share a quote that kind of gets to this. It's one of my favorite pieces of literature. It's from David Abrams' book called Spell of the Sensuous. Our bodies have formed themselves in delicate reciprocity with the manifold textures, sounds, and shapes of an animate earth. Our eyes have evolved in subtle interaction with other eyes. As our ears are attuned by their very structure to the howling of wolves and the honking of geese. To shut ourselves off from these other voices, or continue by our lifestyles to condemn these other sensibilities to the oblivion of extinction, is to rob our own senses of their integrity and to rob our minds of their coherence. We are human only in contact and conviviality with what is not human. And we've lived all of that time, 99% of our time outdoors and in direct connection with natural context. And we don't do that anymore. So our bodies are formed in connection. Our nervous systems are built to respond from a place of being in nature all of the time, looking for threats, but otherwise being very broadly, softly aware of our environment and taking in lots of information at a time, but from a sort of like a difference between fascination, attention, and focused attention, which I can talk about a little bit more too. And in today's world, we have very focused attention. We're on our computer screens. We have 12 windows up at a time. We have people maybe walking into our offices. The phone rings, the Facebook and millions of other notifications coming in on our phone all of the time. And we think we multitask, but that's an illusion. Our brains actually only do one thing at a time. So we're jumping constantly from one thing to the next. And this is keeping us in a heightened sense of awareness and focused attention and stress, frankly. Some of the practice that I do in my work is to support our nervous system to be able to have practice and time in behaviors that our nervous system's built for. So I teach people exercises in how to hold fascination attention, how to take in a broad, soft awareness of their surroundings. And again, over evolutionary time, this is what we did on the landscape. And if a threat showed up, we would be aware of it. We would choose a response, fight, flight, or freeze. If we survived that response, we would go back to our baseline of general soft awareness as the threat passed and start over again and just be aware of what's around us and softly looking for threats. When we are in for the example I just shared, our offices with all of those inputs, it's like we have that focused attention on that threat at all times. So it's not really a threat, but our nervous system's attention to it is the same sort of chemical reaction and energetic reaction as when we have a fight, flight, or freeze threat in our environment evolutionarily, keeping us in this constant mode of sympathetic nervous system response and lots of production of adrenaline and cortisol. And extended periods of time like that is not what our nervous system's built for and not healthy for us physically or cognitively.
How do we balance that fascination and focus in the real world?
Sure. Good question. And I'll back up just a bit to say that the studies show that time outdoors versus indoors is helpful in showing these cognitive and physiological benefits. Time in green spaces outdoors versus urban spaces outdoors, even better. Exercise in these contexts has the same comparisons. Just sitting in these various different contexts has the same comparison. Playing as a child in these various contexts, same comparison. So one thing that we can do alongside busy lives, high demand culture, really sort of money-focused lifestyles, right, which also include production focus, is if we can transfer some of our activities to outdoors or in indoor spaces surrounded by green living things like plants or pets, that is going to give some of these benefits automatically. You can also add to that and have deliberate time in natural spaces where you're dedicating some energy and commitment to your mental and physiological health, much like folks build in meditation practices. You can do the same thing in this relational reawakening and nurturing with nature. And it doesn't have to be in a wilderness area. This is one thing that I really stress to folks is we don't have all access to very, very green spaces or very remote spaces. And although, yes, a walk in a forest has some of these benefits stronger or more immediate than a walk in an urban space, we also need to find the ways to connect with a blade of grass between the road and the sidewalk, as well as an expanse of thousands of acres of wilderness. Because the reality is most of us live with a blade of grass and spend a whole lot more time there. And it still has the ability to nurture this fascination, attention, and this connection, the inspiration, compassion, creativity, all of that. So I would say if folks feel like they can't fit in the time or they don't feel knowledgeable or confident about working in a very deliberate nature relationship nurturing practice in their lives, even dedicating some time to being outside or being in a greener space or with water or with birds helps give these benefits tremendously over being at our computer or in front of blue screens all of the time.
Tell me a little bit about how this looks in your practice, for example.
Sure. The work I do looks and feels fairly similar to forest bathing, for people who are aware of that. Lots of sensory awareness practice and slowing down. And I give people simple exercises that they can take home with them and incorporate fairly quickly in their daily lives, whatever kind of speaks to them. A lot of them are pretty fun and interesting. And really creating the space to open our curiosity and sense our surroundings, practicing with all of those senses. And that's very much part of forest bathing. In my work, I also expand that. And I do orientations to place and natural history and cultural history. I bring in the principles and evidence and practice of nurturing relationship, as well as doing certain things that help us have benefits for human health and wellness. I'm all for the human health and wellness. I'm a scientist. I'm bought into all of this. I believe it. And at the same time, there's so much more. And that more, for me, speaks to my core values of why I'm in this work in the first place. Human health and wellness benefits are gravy. And for me, it's really all about reciprocity with Earth. And as we build these relationships, our environmental knowledge and dedication for change and ability to care for places that we have this relationship and connection to grows. And this is true in the literature as well. All kinds of studies have looked at what drew you to nature in the first place. And what is it that inspires people's environmental action? And it often comes from intimate, repeated, often early life experiences in natural spaces. So for me, it's not necessarily a call out for environmental action per se, but I know that the work we do and the ways we think about this relationship have an impact on the contributions we make in the world and how we treat, frankly, each other as well. So I do the forest bathing type practices of sensory awareness and so forth, but I enter these other aspects as well. And I also really work from a lot of different angles. So I will find myself leading outside in groups of people who want some relief from stress and anxiety, or one-on-one in a private session with somebody who wants some release from stress and anxiety. However, I also work with professionals in natural resources fields who I encourage, and this gets to environmental education versus this other thing that sort of filled the gap in my career. We've come to a place with environmental ed, which is an incredibly important facet of education, of we've all heard look, don't touch, right? There was a great article a while back in Orion magazine about the effects of information, strictly information, and providing that, learning that, but having these parameters of like the best way to protect something is to not engage, really. Learn about it, understand it, but don't touch it, don't hurt it, don't, like, your presence should not be known here. And there is some validity in that. No trace principles, leave no trace principles are important. At the same time, a child who learns the facts about environment is not going to have the same relationship or affect around environment and their context as one who gets to really dig in and engage and collect the ants in the jar and find out how high they can climb before it might hurt them and so forth. So we have a bit of an overprotection in that realm with our children. And often adults are a little bit resigned in that way as well with their interactions outside.
I was very fortunate to be raised next to Vermont Creek, part of the Black Rift watershed system, as a child, just like played in the mud and made mud pies and caught crayfish and all of those things. And yet, I didn't really feel engaged with a crick until we did that exercise at Salmo Pond during the Wisconsin Master Naturalist class.
Oh, how amazing.
And we scooped up water and put it into ice cube trays and looked for those microorganisms. And there was something, the whole theme of that day was kind of looking at the health of a stream based on its smallest critters. Like, who's there? Who's there on a microscopic level? I've thought about it differently since that day, even though I grew up alongside a creek.
Yeah, it makes a difference when we can get dirt under our nails and make our feet wet. And I believe that that has something to do with curiosity and exploration and self-efficacy in the experience that we're having, letting us fully and freely explore. And another thing I focus on in my work, be beckoned. So I invite people to go off on their own a bit in the programs that I run. And I ask them to consider not planning or predetermining where they're going to go explore something or someone or practice a certain sense. Instead, I invite them to allow themselves to be beckoned. Sit alongside whatever your experience is and follow what you're drawn to versus sort of cognitively deciding that I like that shape of that tree or something. So along the lines of environmental education or any education and the information gathering Western science type of view of knowing and understanding and engaging with our world, which again, I'm all about and I fully engage and believe in the value of that. There's other ways of knowing that, especially recently, especially in Western culture, we don't offer sufficient time for. We don't build those muscles. And I really lean into that in my work. And with professionals in a natural resources field, it's amazing how the foresters I work with will see a maple tree and immediately all of this information, all of this technical knowledge they have about maples enters their mind. And they automatically, they're not thinking about it necessarily, but they know, and so they see maple and they're informed by this. I ask them and guide them and support them to set down that expert mind for a moment and reconnect with other ways of knowing maple. And I've heard feedback from them that, wow, I haven't done that in so long. I forgot what that feels like, or I forgot this thing that I used to love about maples that I haven't thought about for a long time. It helps people reconnect to why they got into that professional field in the first place. So I'll work with folks, again, who want some physical or cognitive health benefits, with professionals who I love to work with, other ways of knowing, helps them be more effective, right, in talking with the landowners they work with or other managers they work with, in that connection and understanding of how we can play a role of health and resilience for natural spaces that we own or manage. And then I'll also work with people who are navigating grief. Specifically around climate grief, or a landowner who's watching all of the ash trees on their property die. And also people in ecological restoration, it's called often, I call it ecological regeneration projects, of which I'm involved with a lot as well, who are grappling with the fact of here we are, really wanting to practice reverence for life, and yet with these practices of supporting natural communities who no longer are thriving here because of invasive species or land use changes or whatever, we find ourselves doing a lot of killing. And how do you reconcile that? So I'll work with people from that angle as well.
Is there anything important to this work that we haven't touched on?
Absolutely. As this is trending more, as doctors in America and other Western areas are starting to do nature prescriptions, again, I think that's really beneficial. I think it's really important that we recognize those benefits. And I get concerned that nature will become the next pill. And I encourage folks to lean into the broader context of this relationship they have, and be thinking about it from a perspective of more than what can I get from 20 minutes outside and then walk away and go on business as usual, because you'll get fewer benefits from that. And also you'll have a smaller contribution for your time. And I also want to say that although I've mentioned all humans have this common experience of an inherent connection to natural context from that evolutionary physiological immersion, not all humans have the same cultural and ancestral history since then. So it's easy for many of us to say, it's great to be outside. It feels wonderful to walk through the woods. That is not true for every human being, for real reasons that often are systemic in our systems, in our culture. You can see the differences of green urban spaces and all the benefits that they provide versus very urban industrial spaces. And they follow some of the same geographical boundaries as our policies for redlining in the past. So there's entire facets of our communities of people who do not have equal access to these benefits just off the bat because they're human. And that's something we really need to focus on as well.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. I feel like we could talk about this for hours, but
definitely.
thank you so much for your time today, Colleen. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you on this topic. So thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity. And if people would like to reach out and speak more with me or partner with me on any of this, my LLC is called Nature's Good Company at naturesgoodcompany.com.
You've been listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host, Catherine Garvins. My guest tonight was Colleen Robinson, Certified Mindful Outdoor Guide, Wisconsin Master Naturalist Instructor, and founder of Nature's Good Company. We spoke about the mental and physical health benefits of time spent in nature and green spaces. Thank you to Perpetual Notion engineer Daniel MacArthur and to News and Public Affairs Director Nate Carlin for supporting this show. Thanks for listening and have a great evening.